Morning to all of you, and welcome here this morning. Yeah, just so blessed by the service so far this morning. It's been so good to be here. It's been a couple of weeks since we've been here, so just especially good to be here this morning. I was actually supposed to preach this message about 3 weeks ago, and then we had a snowstorm, and church got canceled that morning, and then we were out of town for the next two Sundays, so here we are 3 weeks later, and my hope is that age has done this message good, like wine, and not like last week's meatloaf that you microwaved to warm up. Anyway, I would like to start off this morning just with talking a little bit about story. That's the title of the message is Our Place in the Story. So I'd like to talk just a little bit about storytelling to start off here. If you've ever had the privilege of listening to someone who's good at telling a story, it's a memorable event. Some people have a way of telling a story that just draws you in. They know which details to include without getting too detailed that you kind of get distracted and lose your focus. My father-in-law is one of those people who can tell a story really well. And I've actually kind of joked before that him and I can share an experience where we both see the same thing happen. And I just kind of pass it off as just normal life. It's just, it's nothing to take note of, really. But later on, he'll come back around, and he'll tell a story about what we experienced. And I'm listening to this story wondering what I missed. How does he pull all these things out of what we saw? I didn't see that, but somehow he did. So anyway, there's a skill to telling a good story, and a story has several key elements to it, and this is by no means a comprehensive lesson on storytelling, but a couple of the key parts of a story are the characters. There's what's known as the protagonist, and that is the main character. That's typically the good guy in the story. He's the one who the story is kind of told, often from his perspective, not necessarily, but often it is. So you have the protagonist, and then you have the antagonist, which is often the bad guy in the story. He's the one who creates the conflict with the main character that creates the actual story. And he's generally seen as the bad guy in the story. So, yeah, just in thinking about our lives and the story that we're all living, we're all a part of a story. So where do we fit into that? What character are we? This is something I've kind of been thinking about in the not-so-distant past, just something rolling around in my head a little bit. What is my part in the story? And if you're like me, we see life through our own perspective. We just kind of see ourselves as the main character. It's just kind of naturally the way it is. Like we're the central character in our story, simply because that's the perspective that we see it from. And everybody else is kind of on the fringes. Like, I mean, they're doing their own thing, but my perspective and what I see is what tends to be the most important to me. So if you stop and think about that for just a little bit, if we all look at life like that, that leaves us living in a world with everybody focused on their own goals and they have their own agenda. where they're the main character. I'm the main character and everybody else is on the periphery. So our perspective massively shapes our view of the story. And I want to just look, just think briefly about the story of Job that we have in the Bible. And we have a kind of a behind-the-scenes look at the story. You know, we can see the conversations between God and the devil, and we know what all of Job's trials, you know, what they're coming from. But Job didn't have that. From his perspective, it's just simply about, you know, all of a sudden everything started going wrong. You know, he lost his children, he lost his livestock, and, you know, he got tormented with disease. So from Job's perspective, you know, the story revolves around all of that. But have you ever thought of all of the other people who were affected by that? You know, for his children, I already mentioned they were all killed. So from his children's perspective, the story just came to a screeching halt. And I don't know if Job had grandchildren or not, but I would assume that maybe he did because of his adult, you know, his adult children. If so, they were all orphaned and left without parents. And then there's also the servants that Job had watching his animals. And I don't know how many that, you know, what kind of numbers we're looking at there, but I would assume with the numbers of animals that he had, we're probably looking at dozens, potentially hundreds of servants that also lost their lives when Job's animals were killed or stolen. So yeah, just all that, just to simply bring out the point of our, you know, our perspective it shapes the way that we view life. And everybody looks at life from their own perspective. So who is at the center of this story that we're living? And we all know the answer to that, right? But I would like to read Matthew chapter 22, verses 35 through 40. It says this, "Then one of them, a lawyer, asked him," that would be Jesus, "a question, testing him and saying, 'Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?' Jesus said to him, 'You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets.'" So God, in his wisdom, in his mercy, has given us something bigger than ourselves to live for. Jesus answers this lawyer's question, and he presents a different way to approach life than simply looking at it through our own perspective with ourselves as the center of the story. God is the center of the story. He is the main character. And so what is our role? Where does that leave us? Rather than focusing on our own agendas and our small little window that we're looking through, our purpose is to love God with all that we have. And that concept of loving God is something that's been a little hard for me to wrap my mind around. I've struggled with actually knowing whether I actually love God or not. Like, how do you judge that? It's not like someone that you can interact with and talk face to face with. You know, I can kind of judge if I love my wife or my children or my, you know, parents, because you interact with them and you can see them, right? So yeah, I've struggled with that a bit. How do I know if I actually love God? But I have come to understand that the answer to that question is actually pretty simple, which is not the same as easy, by the way, but it's pretty simple, and the answer is in John chapter 14, the first part of verse 21. And that says, "He who has my commandments and keeps them, it is he who loves me." So if you obey the commands that God has given, that is how you know if you love God. And what are those commandments? Well, the first one, I want to just refer back to the passage that I read in Matthew, to love God and to love others. Those are the greatest two commandments. And if we follow those two, everything else just kind of falls into place. If we love God and we love our neighbor, we love the people around us the way that Jesus loved us, that those are the only two we have to worry about, because everything else just kind of trickles down from there. I would like to read John chapter 15, verses 10 through 13. And it's kind of saying some of the same things here. But it says, "If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may remain in you and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends." I love how John states this command in verse 11. It's stated as one command. I'm sorry, it's verse 12. "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." It's so simple, yet not easy necessarily. So loving the people around us requires sacrifice. If we're truly going to love the people that we rub shoulders with, that we encounter day to day, it's going to require something of us. And there's a bit of a tension that happens there within me. You know, I feel like if I don't focus on, or if I don't look out for myself, who's going to? You know, if I'm so busy looking out for the people around me, I'm going to get left in the dust. You know, there's just not going to be anybody looking out for me. And so I feel like if I'm going to be happy, if I'm going to enjoy life, I have to look out for myself and make sure that I'm happy, right? Well, according to this passage in John, that's not actually the way that it works. In verse 11 of John chapter 15, Jesus tells his disciples, "These things I have spoken unto you, that my joy may remain in you, and that your joy may be full." And he's talking, previous to this verse, he's talking to his disciples about living a life that is surrendered to Jesus and is fruitful. They're being fruitful, staying connected to Jesus. And then here he's talking about loving the people around him. And he says, "I tell you these things so that your joy, you can have true joy." So it's a bit counterintuitive. You know, I feel like I need to look out for myself to make myself happy. But in doing that, I actually make myself miserable. Because when I'm looking out for myself, I get all wrapped up in my, you know, my own agenda and the things that I want to accomplish. in a, you know, a given day or a period of time, whether it's work goals or whatever it is. And I've found that for myself, when I'm focused on me, I start to have more discontentment. I become more discontent because I compare myself to the people around me. You know, I see the things that they have that I don't. I also have more stress because I'm so worried about whether I'm going to accomplish what I want to, that it just, life becomes more stressful. And another thing is, pride becomes a bigger issue too, because if I actually feel like I'm successful, I tend to attribute those successes to my own hard work and, you know, what I've done, rather than give the credit to God, which is where all good gifts come from. So when we live a life that is focused not so much on ourselves, but on serving those around us, we actually find the space where we were created to function the best. You could call that your sweet spot. You find your sweet spot where you actually find the most fulfillment in life. If you are at all inclined mechanically, or if you enjoy working with engines and that kind of thing, you could probably describe this better than I could, but an engine has a certain range of RPMs, a certain speed of running that where it functions the best. It has the most power, it gets the best fuel economy, just where it's a space where that engine likes to run. And some of you are probably kind of like wondering what in the world I'm talking about, and some of you are like, yeah, I know what you're talking about, that makes sense. But that's the way it is for us. If we live life where we are focused on not so much ourselves, but on loving the people around us, that is, even though it doesn't feel like that's where we're going to find happiness, it is. It's where we find fulfillment. And you've probably noticed, if you spend some time helping other people, serving other people, when you get done with that, at the end of the day, you just feel better about yourself. You feel good. And I hate to admit this, but I asked Google why that is. Why do we feel better when we help each other? Here's what I found. Our body responds to helping other people by releasing endorphins and certain hormones that can actually reduce our pain levels. If you have pain, you might want to try helping somebody. It might reduce the pain. Boosting motivation strengthens connection and trust with each other, and it builds our self-esteem and a sense of accomplishment. So our bodies are actually created to function better when we serve other people. And I would like to just take a little moment here to just commend or put a plug in for our young people who spend time serving other people and sacrificing a job, or sacrifice being in a comfortable space at home to go out and serve, you know, whether it's in our community or whether it's across the country, across the ocean. I love the culture that we have of going out and serving, and I just want to commend that. And if there's any of you young people who are thinking about going into service somewhere, go for it. I think it's so good. It's not only a blessing for the people that you serve, but it's also just life-changing for you also, for the server. And just I'm just excited about the focus that our youth leaders are putting on that too. It's, you know, last night with the Valentine's banquet, preparing to go out to New Horizons. I just thank you guys for the intentional work you're putting into building that culture. All right, I want to just switch gears here a little bit. As I was thinking about living life focused on other people or serving others, there was two different groups of people that came to my mind that can be devalued in our culture. And the first of those two groups of people are people who oppress us or who treat us poorly. Jesus teaches us very clearly how we're to respond to those who misuse us. And we call this teaching non-resistance, which is a term that comes from the passage in Matthew chapter 5 where Jesus says not to resist an evil person. I don't like that term very well. I don't think that it encapsulates what Jesus was teaching very well. It's so much bigger than non-resistance. I'm not going to try to rename it right now. That would take the rest of the day probably. But I feel like there's a better way to talk about what Jesus was trying to teach us there. But I'm going to use that term because it's what we're familiar with. It's becoming increasingly acceptable to call this teaching of non-resistance into question. And in effect, the argument that is being made is, if you threaten the well-being or the safety of me or my family, you have forfeited your right to be treated as a human whose life has value. In other words, if you're a threat to me or my family, I will take whatever steps necessary to protect myself or to stop you. And this is a concept that I've wrestled with myself. You know, before I was married, it wasn't really something that I put a lot of thought into. I was taught this concept growing up, and I didn't really question it too much, I don't think. Put a wife and a few kids in the picture, and something changes. And so I had to wrestle with this concept. Like, where do I actually shake out on this? Just a little story. Shortly after Amber and I moved back here, we were expecting our second child, and we had a two-door car, so we decided to sell that and get a minivan. And so we were going to, I set the old car out by the road, and after a while, I don't remember how long it was, but a young man stopped in and he wanted to buy this thing. So he took it on a little test drive and he said, all right, yep, I'll take it. So he took it and headed out the lane. Well, I think it was the next day. I was at work doing my thing and I get a phone call. And here it's this guy that bought the car, and he is just lays into me, and he said, this car's got a lien on it. I took it to the title shop, or to the BMV to get title and tags, and they towed it. They took the car. It set me on my heels. I didn't know what to say. So I was trying to figure out what am I going to do about this? I mean, I don't want to leave him sit with something that, you know, some mistake that I made. So I said, if there's something wrong, I'll take care of it. I'll deal with it. But I said, I need the title of the car and I need to know where it was towed to. And that just set him off. He just laid into me, cussing me up one side and down the other. And I'd try to talk to him, and I couldn't get a word in edgewise. And he'd just go off, and then he'd hang up. And then a little bit later, he'd call me back again, and he said, you know, you owe me that money back. You give me that money back. And he'd just let me have it again, and then he'd hang up. And I didn't know what to do. I hate selling cars in the first place. I don't want to mess with it. So I didn't know what to do. So I got some advice from some people, and he kept calling me, and finally he said, I'm coming to get my money. And I didn't know what to think, because I didn't know what kind of character this dude was. He didn't look like a super reputable kind of guy in the first place. And I didn't know what he had in mind. And so I was scared. Like I didn't know, you know, when he was going to show up at my door. And I didn't know what lengths he was going to go to try to get his money back. And quite frankly, honestly, I would have felt a lot better if I could have, in good conscience, pulled out my shotgun and sat on the front porch and waited for him. I'm just being honest. But I cannot, you know, in studying and looking at the life of Jesus and what he taught us, I can't justify that. I just can't. And as I wrestled with this previous to this encounter, as I wrestled with this, I wanted to come out at a place that was different than what I was taught growing up. Because I feel like if I have some control, you know, I can kind of make things go the way I want them to, right? But yeah. So here's where I came out in my wrestling. Taking a life puts me in a role that only God can justly fill. I simply just don't have the ability to make that kind of a decision or that call with my extremely limited frame of reference. And if I put myself in that role, I assume to know whose life is more valuable. If a life is going to be ended, I know whose it should be. I believe that this mindset places me as the central character to a story that's so much bigger than I am. And there are just so many stories of people sacrificing their lives in order to love like Jesus taught us to, and those sacrifices resulting in people coming to know the Lord. So many stories like that. Just one, Jim Elliot. Him and four other men had a burden to reach the Aka Indians in Ecuador, I believe. And they ended up sacrificing their lives in trying to reach those those people. And a quote of Jim's, and I just marvel at this, the depth of this quote, but Jim said, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." And I'm just amazed at the depth of that. If you think about that for a little bit, it's so profound. But those five men laid down their lives in trying to reach the Indians. And you know, I have to wonder how much differently that story would have turned out if they would have defended their lives, you know, at the expense of the lives of their attackers. I did a little research, and I'm not going to go into the details, but I did a little research on what transpired after this with those Indians, and it's amazing. It's just amazing how God used that sacrifice to work in that community of people. So who is to say how God can use a story of radical love in the face of evil? And I I don't want to minimize the pain of a tragic loss like that, or even suggest that something like that is God's will being worked out. I don't believe that. But I do believe that God is big enough to use those tragic events to build his kingdom. And then one more thought on this. I think, again, I don't mean to devalue human life, but I think sometimes we take ourselves too seriously. Like, we feel like if we don't live a long, full life here on earth, we've been cheated out of something. But if you look at the span of our lives here on earth compared to eternity, whether we live for 20 years or 80 years, there's really no difference. It's all just a snap of the fingers and it's over. So, yeah, these are some of the thoughts that I've kind of come to through wrestling with this myself. And I think sometimes it's easy to get intimidated when we see people wrestling with things like this. And we feel like it's kind of scary territory. but I think it's healthy. I think it's so good. It was good for me. I should say it that way. It was so good for me to just wrestle with that and to own it myself and not just do it because that's what I was taught as a kid it was so good. And so I think we need to allow space for people to wrestle through these kind of things. I'd like to just take a bit more of a practical look at non-resistance. I already referred to this, but the non-violence part of non-resistance is just the tip of the iceberg. Jesus gave us a lot of instruction on what we should do instead of resisting. And I think I maybe kind of already went over this, but that's the reason I don't like the term non-resistance, because there's just so much more to it. I would like to actually, let me back up just a little bit, kind of to what I was talking about earlier. It's actually pretty unlikely that any of us will come into a situation where we're forced to make a decision whether we're going to defend our life by taking another life. It happens, but it's not something that we're going to face very likely. But on the other hand, all of us at some point or another have to decide how we are going to love or how we're going to treat people who we rub shoulders with every day that wrong us. Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 through 44. Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him two. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you." So at the core of this teaching of Jesus is a supernatural love towards people who are our enemies, people who oppose us, people who hate us, curse us, abuse us, and persecute us. Paul speaks to this also in Romans chapter 12, and I want to just read that passage. Romans 12, verses 14 through 21. Bless those who persecute you, bless and do not curse. Rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. Be of the same mind toward one another. Do not set your minds on high things, but associate with the humble. Do not be wise in your own opinion. Repay no one evil for evil, having regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in doing so, you will heap coals of fire on his head. So just a couple of thoughts on this passage. Verse 15 says, rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. And I never connected before that this verse is placed in, in these instructions on how to treat people who oppose us. I always just kind of looked at it like, if the people around you, your brother, your whoever, your parents are rejoicing, rejoice with them. If they're sad, come alongside them and weep with them. But it's actually placed with the instructions on how to treat our enemies. And that takes it to a whole new level. If we can rejoice when our enemy has successes, or if we can weep when they are hurting, that's just a whole nother level. That's a supernatural love that is just, it's not within me. That doesn't just come from within me. That has to come through a relationship with Jesus. And then verse 19 says, beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is mine to repay. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Seeking revenge is outside of our role. The authority to seek revenge is God's alone. All right, and then, so I told you there was two groups of people that came to mind that are not valued the way they should be sometimes. The second group that I would like to talk about is children. There's a quote, and I don't know exactly where this quote comes from, but it goes like this. The true measure of a society can be found in how it treats its most vulnerable. And I think it's fair to say that children fall into that category of being vulnerable. And if there is any accuracy to this quote, then I feel like our society is woefully lacking. I don't know if you've ever thought about it before, but when adults make selfish choices, who typically pays the highest price? It's children. Almost always. And our society says it's socially acceptable, it's the right thing to say that we love our children and that we would do whatever we need to for them. You hear that all the time. But then some of these same people that say this, when the rubber meets the road and they're faced with choosing what's easy for them or choosing what's best for their child, is pretty often what's easy for the adult. Think about the, some of the struggling marriages where children are present. We could work through this. We can work through these hard times and keep our marriage going and do the work to make it healthy. Or we can split up, take what looks like the easy route, split up. And so often, the hard work just looks like too much. And so adults part ways and leave children without both parents in the home. And also, Pastor James had a talk the other night at the parent-teacher event here in the fellowship hall. And he was talking about being consistent, being a consistent parent, and just, you know, doing the hard work, the repetitive work to continue to over and over point our child in the right direction. And I think a lot of times it's that is an area where adults don't love their children very well either. We look at that repetition and it's just exhausting sometimes. You know, your child just over and over and over turns the wrong way, figuratively. And it's hard work to continue to correct and to do it gently and lovingly, to continue to correct. It's hard work. And I think a lot of times parents, number one, I think parents have maybe a twisted view of what loving their child is sometimes. And we feel like maybe loving our child is just letting them do what they want to. Let them be happy. That's not loving our child. And also, we're just too lazy sometimes, too. So, yeah, I feel like our society as a whole, you know, we say we love our children, but then we don't do the hard work to raise them the way that they need to be raised. And that creates children that are hard to live with. If you take your kids out into public, wherever, it doesn't take very long till you get some comments about, man, that's a lot of kids. You got your hands full. Or my hat's off to you. You're a better parent than I am, or, you know, something like that. And I think it's often well-meaning. They recognize that it's hard work, and it is. But I think there's also a bit of a negative connotation to some of those comments, too. Our society, I think, views children as a burden sometimes, and they're these little people that get in the way of what I want to do and, you know, my agenda. We have, as parents, as teachers, whoever, if you're working with children, you have a tremendous opportunity to shape the way that they view themselves and view the world around them. Probably most of us here, if we were to sit down and just talk about it around a table over lunch or something, we would have, probably most of you all would have memories of something that you were told as a child, be it positive, negative, or something maybe that you learned, that you were taught as a child that has stuck with you until today and probably will until you take your last breath. The things that we hear, learn as a child, can stick with us and shape our life throughout the entirety. And that's why it's so important for us to take our interactions with children seriously, whether they're our own or you know, nieces, nephews, students, whatever the case. We have a tremendous ability to shape the way that they see themselves. And one seemingly insignificant interaction with a child can shape them for the rest of their life. Something that we don't even think about. We don't give it a second thought. But it can shape the way that child sees themselves. So just a couple of thoughts on interacting with children. Take the time to listen. Yesterday, I was out cutting some firewood out behind the house, and Emerson, my two-year-old, was out there just climbing around in the logs and watching and hanging out with me, and I looked over at him as I was running my chainsaw with my earplugs in, and he's over there talking. And I was kind of curious what he wanted to say, so I shut my saw off and I asked him what he needed, or I forget, yeah. But he said, "Dad, my boots are dirty." Just, that's what he wanted to say. My boots are dirty. So, you know, sometimes we we think maybe it's not worth the time to stop and listen. But listening assigns value. When we take the time to listen to children, it tells them that they're valuable. And also, I think it's important to know children's names and to use them. And that's no small feat, especially here. There's a lot of children, a lot of names to remember. And some of you do so well at that. And it blesses me as a parent when I see that. So kudos to you. And if you don't know them all, I'm not judging you. I don't know them all either. It's hard to keep up. But I think it is important to a child to just be called by name and to be known. And it's something that I really appreciate about you all is just the value that is placed on family and children. And I just want to thank you for the time that you invest in our children. Thank you for overlooking the flaws in our parenting sometimes. And also, I want to thank you for patiently being mobbed for candy every Sunday morning after the service. Sometimes it's a bit of a stampede. All right, so in wrapping this up, a few key thoughts that I have. The story is God's. He's the main character. We are to love God, which is expressed by our obedience to his commands and our love for each other. Secondly, we are not here on earth to build our own empire. Our life is best spent being laid down for others. Not only is it the right thing to do, it's where we find fulfillment. Just a little note on, I'm not sure what the passage is where Jesus says, "Greater love has no man than a man lay down his life for his friend." When I read that verse, I automatically think about dying. Like you lay down your life to save your friend's life or something like that, like physical death. But I wonder if it's not talking more about just being willing to lay aside my own preferences, my own agenda, in order to love my brother or sister. All right, and then lastly, if our non-resistance ends at non-violence, we've missed the point. We're called to a sacrificial and an active love towards those who don't deserve it, which is the same way that Jesus loved us when he died for us while we were still opposed to him. So. Okay, so those are my thoughts for this morning. Thanks for listening. Pastor Jake, would you close? All right.